Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. When someone's dealing with a mental health crisis, often the first call for help goes to 911 and to a police dispatcher. Earlier this year, all police dispatchers in Chicago's 911 Operations Center got extra training on how to recognize and respond to mental health crises. For Chicago, the move came after a scathing Justice Department report, but the problem in search for solutions is nationwide. Today, we'll be learning more about the role of police dispatchers and mental health awareness and how that's changed in Illinois. Back in March, we spoke with David Tuttle. He's the manager of the Emergency Communications Center for the City of Peoria. And first, I welcomed him to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So looking at just some of the numbers that are out there so people can kind of get a sense of what this looks like, about 1 in 10 police calls involve mental health situations. That's according to an article I saw in Governing Magazine. In Peoria, what's the role of the dispatcher when one of those calls come in?
The role of the 911 dispatcher is to obviously listen to the caller, try and understand exactly what kind of need they may have of services, and then to send out the appropriate responder while continuing to listen to the caller and try and keep the caller calm while getting information for the responders as they travel to the scene.
And I mean, I imagine, you know, the only way to do that is to, I mean, you have to very quickly kind of build trust, I guess, to keep them talking, to be comfortable to tell you what's happening.
Yes. I mean, you don't necessarily want to pry, deep into what the situation may be, but you want to get the caller's first name and attempt to develop a quick rapport with the caller while at the same time getting the responders to the location so that they can actually, speak to them firsthand. In Peoria, we have a service called the Emergency Response Service, which is basically a mobile counselor that has that is dispatched through the 911 center here in Peoria, and we actually send those folks with the police or the emergency medical services folks directly to the person's home.
Oh, so there are additional resources. Let's talk about that in a minute. I'm curious to know more about it. You know, coming back to the moment on the phone when you're talking to somebody in a very short amount of time, you have to kind of figure out what the need is there and then make sure the right services go out. You know, when it comes to figuring that out, when it comes to identifying when a caller might need mental health assistance, what does that process look like? How do you get to that point?
Well, it could be very high risk. If the caller is calling and they've already made a determination in their own mind that they're going to, let's say, take their life and they may have a gun or a knife in their hands, then it's very important that the dispatcher work as quickly as possible to try and develop some sort of rapport with the person while all in while sending out the responders to try and get there in time before the person would actually make that decision. It's unfortunately not unusual for the dispatcher to actually be a part of that scene when the person actually, you know, does something like that. So it's it really kind of varies. If it's something that's immediately possibly going to happen, then that's much different than if somebody calls and states that they're going to or they're considering taking pills or they may have taken pills or something like that. It's while still very important, it's not, you know, something immediate like someone having a gun or a knife or something like that.
You mentioned earlier that there was a mental health professional who was available and could be called in certain situations. So it's not just, you know, police handling everything on their own. How has that relationship developed and what is it? How does it work now?
Well, I've been the manager of Peoria's Emergency Communications Center since 1995, and when I started here in 1983, we had the service. So the service has been in place for over 35 years, and basically it's called the Emergency Response Service. And it was created by one of our police superintendents many years ago to try and bridge the gap and to provide assistance to police, fire, and emergency medical services to have a trained mental health professional actually meet with the person literally in their home with the officer there, or the emergency response service worker also does respond to the emergency room or to other locations to assist folks. So it's a fairly unique situation that is available in Peoria, and it is one that is its need is great. They're a very busy service, and I'm not sure that we would be able to do without their services.
Have you seen, just curious, with some of the issues around the state budget, and we've heard a lot about some crisis centers and other places closing who provide a lot of mental health services, have you seen an uptick in calls involving mental health crises?
Yes, we've seen, we used to have a mental health facility here in Peoria called Zeller Mental Health Center, and it was a large facility that treated both adults and adolescents. And since that facility has been closed for over 10 years, it actually, our calls for service in this particular area, that, and police and emergency response service workers, you know, are dealing with a lot more folks that potentially would have been residents of that center or something like that, and may have even been, you know, inpatient or outpatient treatment.
Yeah, and found care in other ways. Well, I mean, that kind of leads to a question. You know, for someone who does find themselves in the position of having to dial 911 because, you know, someone around them or themselves is having a mental health crisis, do you have any advice? What should people know when they have to pick up that phone?
When they pick up the phone and call 911, I mean, obviously what we need first is the address, and then again, what type of information. But many times that's the last resort for the caller, or what they believe is the last resort. So they're really reaching out. It's a cry for help. So the dispatcher really is the person on the line that can really make or break the that particular situation. So the dispatchers are trained to listen to what the caller has to say, to emphasize, provide empathy with the caller, and to really, you know, have that caring, caring and compassion to the caller as much as possible till the responders actually get on the scene. You know, being a 911 dispatcher is an extremely difficult job. You really do not know what that next call for service is going to be.
David Tuttle is the manager of the Emergency Communications Center for the City of Peoria. David, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We mentioned earlier that the City of Chicago recently completed training all of its dispatchers in, among other things, recognizing and responding to mental health calls. Let's bring into this conversation now Dr. Julie Morita. She's the Public Health Commissioner for the City of Chicago. And Dr. Morita, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you just heard there, you know, David Tuttle, he's in Peoria, talk a little bit about some of the things that they're doing in that city. You know, how there's what he called a sort of a mobile counselor unit that collaborates with law enforcement. As the public health commissioner in Chicago, what kinds of ways are you seeing public health collaborate with police and emergency dispatchers on mental health issues?
So just to give a little background, the Department of Public Health and the mayor last year, about a year ago, launched our Healthy Chicago 2.0 mm-hmm. plan, which is a public health plan for the next 4 years. And among the top priorities that were identified in terms of health conditions was behavioral health, because we know nationwide there are problems with the behavioral health system, whether it's mental health or substance use disorder treatment. And so we have prioritized that. And as a result, there's been significant investments in terms of addressing this need. What Mr. Tuttle described in terms of Peoria's focus on and emphasis on 911 dispatchers being appropriately trained. We just completed training of 100% of our 911 call takers and dispatchers so that they have background and information about individuals who might have mental health or substance use disorder, so they're able to make that distinction about what kind of services are needed. Do they need a crisis intervention trained police officer, or do they need a fire department to come out? So it's really a matter of getting the 911 dispatchers, because they play such a critical role in terms of having them understand what kinds of needs are out there and who best to dispatch.
So that training, it sounds like, focused on being able to recognize in those first, you know, early moments, or what questions to ask, or maybe I should ask the question, what did that training involve? What did they kind of learn how to do?
So the the dispatchers were received training to understand mental health conditions and signs and symptoms of those kinds of conditions, and also some de-escalation training. Because as mm-hmm. Mr. Tuttle mentioned earlier, you have to actually keep the individuals calm on the phone while the responders are on their way. And so it's not just a matter of understanding and dispatching appropriate. It's also helping to de-escalate situations over the phone. So the 911 dispatchers were trained. And then in addition to that, the city is committed to having 35% of our police officers crisis intervention trained as well, which means that they go through a comprehensive 40-hour training program where they themselves learn how to interact with individuals who might have mental health issues or substance use disorders to help them deal with the acute situation and then get them to the appropriate services that they need.
So with certain calls, the dispatchers might be able to route the call or send the call out to those trained officers to be able to respond, at least in certain situations.
That's right. I mean, I think we are, you know, it's a whole continuum that needs to be addressed. So the public needs to know that there are police officers who are appropriately trained to help individuals with behavioral health disorders so they can ask for a crisis intervention trained police officer who is specially equipped to make that distinction and get their loved one to appropriate care. And so we've trained. We're working on a pilot project on the west side of Chicago to educate the public about the availability of these services. Our 911 dispatchers are then trained to dispatch appropriately, and then our police officers are trained to identify individuals that have these problems and also to get them the appropriate services. So we're trying to address all levels of this continuum.
So you've got that continuum, you know, and you mentioned Healthy Chicago 2.0 includes some of the efforts you described, but what kinds of things can communities do to reach people in crisis before they have to pick up the phone and are at that moment where they have to dial 911?
Well, I think there's a because in nationwide and in the state and in the city, there we recognize that there's a need for behavioral health services that is not being met. And so there's been significant investments from the federal government to try to increase services through federally qualified health centers. So health centers are being asked to or expected to integrate behavioral health services with their primary care services. And on top of that, many of our healthcare systems and hospitals are enhancing their behavioral health systems to make them more strong and more robust. But in the meantime, when people still are calling 911, we are working with our system to make sure that those individuals who are part of that system actually are best equipped. But there are definite efforts to increase the availability of behavioral health services throughout the city.
So trying to do, you know, for years we've heard that law enforcement across the state and even the country has said that too often police and jails kind of take on the role of the crisis counselors. A lot of efforts, it sounds like they're not just in Chicago but around the state, trying to bridge some of those divides and bring behavioral health and some more professional help into that cycle that you're talking about.
That's right. I mean, our goal really is to keep those people who have behavioral health issues out of the criminal justice and get them connected to care. We just opened, on the far side of Chicago, we opened up a community triage center with Cook County Health and Hospital Systems. And what that is, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week program where people that come and have crisis can walk in or be brought in by police officers to get the medical care that they need so they don't end up in the criminal justice system.
You know, you heard David there talk about how they're seeing more and more people calling 911, particularly mentioned now with fewer resources available to mental health treatment. Is Chicago seeing a similar increase in those kinds of calls?
Well, what we do know is that because of the training that our 911 dispatchers received, that there was a significant increase in the number of calls that were classified as requiring these kinds of services. And that's a good thing. What it means is that our staff are better able to identify people who have these type of needs and then appropriately dispatch the appropriately trained police officers. So the fact that our dispatchers are trained, the fact that we'll have more police officers that are trained will assure that those individuals who happen to call 911 for assistance actually end up in care and not in the criminal justice system.
I see. So it could be part that it's being recognized more and maybe part that the need is growing a little bit too, but perhaps.
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish between the two.
Yeah. So either way, we're starting to see at least the reports of people needing some of these services going on. The state budget cuts, at least in Peoria, we're not helping the situation there. How do you think law enforcement, you know, needs to adapt sort of at this moment in time, do you think, you know, if more and more emergency calls are involving some type of mental health crisis?
I mean, I think this training that we offer our police officers is a critical step. It allows the officers to understand and recognize people who are struggling with mental health issues or substance use disorders and then recognize that they would be better served if they were in an emergency room or if they were in a triage center where they can get connected to ongoing care. If people get connected to the ongoing care, they're less likely to end up in the criminal justice system. And so awareness is really critical. But it's not just the police, really. It's a matter of raising awareness in the public so that mental illness and substance use disorders are destigmatized and people recognize that there are health conditions that need treatment and that it's okay and appropriate to get treatment. So, you know, the law enforcement is just one piece of the puzzle in order for us to really assure that people's behavioral health issues are being addressed. We really have to raise awareness about and destigmatize these disorders and also increase access to the services that are available. And then by making people aware of these kinds of problems in the community, there's a sensitivity and ability to get people connected to care that is available versus ending up by calling a police officer.
Yeah. In your mind, what's next? What are some of the proactive steps that the city wants to take now?
One of the primary goals of Healthy Chicago 2.0 is to make the city of Chicago trauma-informed. We recognize that people are traumatized on a daily basis, and it can be related to violence, but it also can be related to food, lack of housing, and not enough money coming in because of lack of employment. Mm-hmm. All these traumatic to individuals, and our goal really is to make the city of Chicago trauma-informed, which means raising people's awareness to the fact that people have this trauma in their lives, recognizing when they have a problem, and then helping them to get access to the services that they need. And so this is a goal of ours. We're marching forward with this effort. We've already done some training with Presence Health System, which is a healthcare system in Chicago, to make training available to all our aldermen and to their aldermanic staff in the communities. We're working on training our health department staff and also our library staff, okay. And then we'll head out to different city agencies and different community organizations in the city to help them raise their awareness.
With awareness and some of those
awareness
things. Well, Dr. Morita, I'm sorry to have to jump in here. We are just out of time, but thank you very much. Dr. Julie Morita, Public Health Commissioner with the City of Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The conversation on how to improve our public schools has been ongoing for years, and there's lots of ways that presidents have tried to solve this, whether we think about the No Child Left Behind or now Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's advocacy for expanding charter schools and voucher programs. When we talk about improving schools, integration is often a term that comes up. When we use the word integration, we tend to think about race and ethnicity. But Richard Kahlenberg, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, says he has a solution that focuses on social and economic diversity. The idea is that students from schools in areas with higher poverty actually do better when they have classmates that have more socioeconomic diversity. And that's a far more powerful thing than just providing more resources to those schools. The bipartisan think tank Century Foundation recently released a paper that used nine different case studies to further this argument. And two of those case studies were in Illinois, in Chicago and Champaign schools. Richard Kahlenberg is on the line with us now from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Julie Wirth, a reporter at the News Gazette in Champaign, to discuss both of these school districts. Richard, Julie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Richard, let's start with you. First, what's the general idea behind why having middle class, and I don't know if you also include upper income students, mixing that student population with lower income students, how does that help improve the situation?
Well, there's research going back 50 years to suggest that one of the best things we can do for low income students is give them a chance to go to economically mixed schools as opposed to high poverty schools. So in these economically diverse, often racially diverse schools, students are surrounded by peers who have big dreams. Many of them expect to go on to college. They're also surrounded by a group of parents who are in a position to, you know, be active in school affairs, volunteer in class. They're not working three jobs the way a lot of low-income families are. And you tend to get the strongest teachers in economically mixed schools as opposed to high poverty schools. And so nationally, low-income students who are in middle-class schools are as much as 2 years ahead of low-income students stuck in high poverty schools. And the last reason to be for this is that middle-class students and white students will also benefit from diversity and learning from the different perspectives that different life experiences help shape from students of all backgrounds.
Now, in this most recent paper that you all put out, you looked at nine different case studies. Why did the Century Foundation decide to include Champaign and Chicago schools in this nationwide look at this?
Well, for different reasons. Champaign is one of the leading school districts for using choice rather than, you know, the old style of compulsory busing for integration. And they've done a really good job of marrying the idea of choice and school diversity. So I think about 90% of parents get one of their first choices among a variety of options, and so that's part of why we thought they were important to look at. In the case of Chicago, it has one of the most innovative socioeconomic integration programs and helps demonstrate that it's possible, even in a very large district, even one that has high levels of poverty, to try to begin to integrate at least a subset of schools. I should add that, you know, in neither of the cases is the system perfect. There's some challenges which we can talk about, but these were two illustrations of interesting and innovative programs that I think are important for people to know about.
Well, before we get into the specifics of those, let's start with Champaign. Julie, you cover education for the News Gazette. Can you sort of explain how choice works? And with, I think a lot of people hear terms of school choice and wonder if you can explain to our listeners how that works in Champaign specifically.
Well, yes, and this started some years ago through a consent decree, as the Century Foundation's report points out. So each family, when their child is ready to enter kindergarten, gets to make, I think it's up to 5 choices now for where they'd like to send their child, which elementary school, and there are 11 in the district as a whole. And the system tries to balance those choices throughout the district by socioeconomic status. They started out using race as a factor, but after a Supreme Court decision that sort of said that wasn't a good idea, they switched to socioeconomic status. And so as the report says, 90% of the families get their first choice, or get one of their choices, not their first choice. And then that child stays at that school, and they have sibling preference for any, you know, brothers or sisters that come along later. And schools are then assigned to a particular middle school so that balance theoretically would, go all the way through 8th grade. And then the high schools are set up differently. They're based on residential, you know, where you live, as far as which school you're assigned to. But some schools are overchosen, some are underchosen, but they're supposed to fall within 15% of the district average in terms of socioeconomic status.
Well, Julie, what I was wondering was, what's the history of how Champaign got to this point of this system? Because I know in the 1940s, the schools were not integrated. We're thinking about, you know, as per typical all-Black and all-white schools. How did we get to where we are now?
Well, as you said, before Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, the schools were fairly segregated. The North End schools tended to be all Black, although some of those had been white in earlier years, you know, when there were other immigrants from other parts of the world. But after, I think only 5 of the 17 elementary schools in Champaign in the 1940s were integrated at that time. And then after the decision, they gradually did desegregate, but it was mostly by they created a magnet school called Booker T. Washington, which is still there, and made it an arts magnet school, and trying to entice white families to come to that school, which was in North Champaign. And then Black students were essentially bused around the district. That's how the schools were desegregated. So the white students were bused by choice, as they say. The Black students were bused by forced busing. And then in the 1990s, a group of community parents, mostly African American, you know, sort of were tired of the system and ended up filing a lawsuit against the school district, or a complaint saying that it was unfair to Black students to be forcibly bused. And the district, after, you know, much consideration, decided to adopt this controlled choice plan, which was modeled after one in Massachusetts, I believe. And that's kind of where we ended up, where we are now.
And how does Champaign compare to, you mentioned Urbana, how does Champaign compare to the district? Do you have a sense of how it compares to other places in central Illinois in terms of diversity?
I think most of the cities downstate, Springfield, Bloomington, Urbana, would have similar diversity in terms of the district as a whole, in terms of low-income student percentage. I know Urbana's is higher than Champaign's. I don't know what the specific percentages are in Springfield and Bloomington, but I think the, you know, makeup is similar. And I, you know, I think the difference is, you know, Urbana desegregated by basically busing Black students as well around the district, and then taking the children of graduate students who lived in Orchard Downs and bringing them up to Martin Luther King School, which then developed, sort of made, you know, took that situation and ran with it and made itself into this wonderful international program with students from all over the world. But, you know, the Urbana white families, you know, who were permanent residents, really didn't have to be bused against their will, as they said. So both districts sort of tried to find a creative way not to disrupt white students initially when this all came down. But, you know, that district is more, I think, naturally integrated these days, although, you know, I think I think they changed things at King, and they made Leal Elementary School, Leal Elementary School became kind of a dual language program for a lot of Hispanic students, and that's become a very successful program. So they've tried creative ways to do this.
Yeah, it's interesting. The language, it turns out to be a big draw for middle class, probably, parents as well, right? And that's a way to kind of bring in.
That was the idea, yes, right.
And has that worked, would you say?
I think it has. I don't know as much about that, but I mean, from everything I hear, it seems to work well. You know, most parents these days would like their children to have a second language, you know, starting early. One of the complaints I have about schools is that children don't get language instruction until middle school, you know, way past the time when they learn it easily.
Right, so, when they absorb, right. So having right, these elementary programs, right.
Right, their brains are more flexible. And actually, Champaign is starting a similar thing with their international academy. They've started at a school in central Champaign. It's dual language instruction from day one in every class. So students learn in Spanish and English every day, both students with a Spanish background and students with an English background. So there, you know, there are innovative programs going on to try to further this in ways that appeal to parents of all backgrounds. You know, as he was saying before, I think that's a key with all of this is that. You know, you don't want to alienate one group of parents by trying to help another group, because what ends up happening is then people leave. You know, people go to private school, people go to Catholic school, and the problem just sort of perpetuates itself. So I think, as he said, the key is to make middle-class and upper-class parents think, this can benefit me too.
And do you have a sense that you think that has worked in the Champaign area?
I think it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, I feel like the school district provides excellent education. There's so many talented kids in the school system. We've gotten an excellent education for our two kids, I will say, in public schools. But as I said before, you know, the private school population is growing. There's a brand new academy that's being created in the U of I Research Park, very expensive, although they said they'll have scholarships. And, you know, trying to appeal to academic parents, I think, that place a high priority on education. But again, you know, you're drawing kids who might otherwise go to public school, maybe to another private school, but you know, I think that's a bit worrisome for the future of public schools. I think we have to think about that as a society. I have nothing against them, but, you know, they are not as socioeconomically diverse as public schools are.
Yeah, Richard, as Julie is just talking about socioeconomic status, free and reduced lunch has traditionally been a way that we kind of distinguish that often in a school setting. Is there sort of an ideal ratio or proportion of variety of students in terms of socioeconomic status? Like, are there percentages, or how would that work, Richard?
Well, the best evidence we have suggests that students will do well in schools that are between 30 and 70% low income. That is 30 and 70% eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And that has to do with the two reasons that we want integration. So on the one hand, we want to avoid concentrations of poverty because we know that that tends to depress student achievement. And so that's why it's important to get below 70% low income. At the same time, there are positive benefits to diversity that are more apparent when students don't feel completely isolated. So that's why it's better to have that minimum of 30% low income, so that you don't have a situation where a school lacks a critical mass of low income or minority students, and therefore the students don't feel comfortable participating in class. So one of those benefits of diversity is that students will be exposed to different sets of life experiences, and we want students to really participate in classroom discussion, and when they feel isolated, they're less likely to participate.
When we think about that, Julie, what does it look like in terms of Champaign schools? Are Champaign schools across the district meeting that threshold of around 30%, or are there schools that are a little bit different?
There are some lower and some higher. I was just looking at the district-wide average. It's closer to 60% in terms of low income.
60.
Mm-hmm. 60, yes. Okay. And which Urbana is even higher, our sister city here. The school my kids attended, Southside, is a smaller school, and it traditionally fell below that threshold. And some schools were higher. So what you see in Champaign is more and more private schools and sort of quote-unquote suburban school districts, drawing families away that are in higher income brackets. So the public schools are left with a greater share of kids, you know, from low-income families. So we've seen that going up over the years. So, you know, this is a struggle for the school districts because, of course, you know, that brings with it other issues. And part of the choice system is to try to, you know, as he said, spread that out and make sure one school doesn't have too high a percentage. But, you know, it does vary.
Mm-hmm. So, Richard, what Julie's talking about in terms of diversity of schools, you were talking about sort of that 30% being ideal. Julie's giving us an example of the Champaign-Urbana being close to about 60%. What does that look like nationally? What are we at nationally when we look at public schools in terms of, do we have kind of nationally the way the system is right now? Is it pockets of high concentration, like high poverty schools versus other schools?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of economic segregation in residential areas, and that's reflected in our public school system. So we've seen a growth in the proportion of students going to high poverty schools, you know, those that are really above 70-75% low income, and that's had negative effects on academic achievement. So you know, nationally, we're seeing the kind of the resegregation of schools by race and also increasing segregation by income, which is really of great concern educationally. It's encouraging that there are now 100 school districts, including places like Champaign and Chicago, which are trying to do something to address those inequalities and make sure that everyone can get a good education in a solid, diverse setting.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about how K through 12 schools and the difference it makes with those schools to have a good mix of high income and low income students and middle income students in there too. This has been found to be a really effective way to eliminate school inequalities and improve outcomes for all of the students. My guests are Richard Collenberg, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, and Julie Worth, a reporter at the News Gazette in Champaign. Richard, just before the break, we were talking about how Champaign has established a school system that promotes socioeconomic diversity. And I wanted to ask you, what did you find in Chicago? What are the ways Chicago's doing this when we think about Chicago being a city with such wide disparity? You know, lots of people talk about how there are two Chicagos. There's the wealthy Chicago and then the very poor parts of Chicago. And not very much middle class. So how is Chicago trying to handle this?
Right. Well, Chicago has large numbers of low-income students in the public school system. And so simply doing what Champaign is seeking, where all the schools would be roughly comparable, would really end up meaning that all the schools would be high poverty, which is not ideal. And so instead, Chicago seeks to socioeconomically integrate a subset of schools. So these are the magnet schools that people choose into, and what they call the selective enrollment schools. These are the schools that students test into, and you know, students who are doing well academically. The problem is that if those selective enrollment schools were based simply on academic achievement as traditionally understood, you could end up with those schools being overwhelmingly wealthy and white and Asian, and that's not good for our society. And so Chicago is trying to honor merit by looking at academic achievement of students in the context of what obstacles those students have had to overcome. So if a low-income student who is from a single-parent family and faces lots of disadvantages, manages to do pretty well considering what hurdles they had to overcome, then they ought to be given a shot to go to these selective schools.
And Chicago's so, always still yeah. tough with that, right? Because there's such a proportion of families that can afford to deliberately send their kids to private schools for pre-high school to have them prepare so they can test in well into a selective enrollment school as well. So that's another thing that kind of complicates things with Chicago.
Well, that's right. And so if Chicago relied simply on the academic criteria, they'd give, in essence, an unfair advantage to all the wealthier students who've been able to purchase a superior education. And so instead, what Chicago does is they say, okay, you know, we believe in merit, we believe in academic criteria, but at the same time, we want to make sure that there are some fairness guidelines in place to ensure that we're tapping into the talents of more disadvantaged students. And so Chicago divides the census tracts into four different socioeconomic tiers, from the most advantaged to the least advantaged, and then allocates seats so that the most academically able students from each of those categories has an opportunity to attend the selective schools. And as a result, the Chicago public selective schools are far more racially and ethnically diverse than in some jurisdictions like New York City, where you have tiny numbers of African American and Latino students at the selective schools, because they aren't considering that question of fairness and whether students have overcome obstacles.
Well, when we think about this, I wonder, Julie, I have a question for you about Champaign. If there's a sense, as you cover this issue on a local level, I imagine you hear from both students and from parents and families. What's the sense of how this has been working in Champaign? Is this a popular thing for the community?
As far as the choice system?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, kind of goes up and down. It was controversial when it was put in place, but it was also seen by its proponents as a creative way to deal with, you know, the racial disparities in the schools. And as it's evolved, you know, into an economic factor, I think it's sort of less visible, you know, and maybe we're just used to it by now. And I don't have little kids anymore, so I don't hear parents complaining as much. And it's worked out, you know, fairly well. But I think the thing the school district is grappling with now, as the report points out, is not just, you know, sort of balancing the schools on a numbers basis, but access to those, you know, challenging gifted programs and honors classes, you know, similar to what he was talking about with Chicago's magnet schools, you know, how to get more diversity in those programs as well. And I think that's what the district, you know, is sort of struggling with now. They've tried some programs to encourage that, but they still got some work to do there.
Right, right. As we think about this going forward, Julie, I wonder if you could just answer, just before the break, we were talking about when this was implemented and how popular it was. And you were also just talking about the challenges of those higher level advanced placement classes, gifted classes, honors classes. Richard, what are ways that schools can do better at integrating students in? I think so much of the model of what we're talking about is test-based. And as you said, part of that is inherently flawed. What are best practices you've learned from other school districts about how they're learning to integrate students more into these higher level classes?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case studies that my colleague Hallie Potter worked on, she compared Champaign, which is has struggled a little bit with some of the tracking issues, where low-income students and minority students end up in the lower tracks by and large, and you know, white and wealthier students end up at the higher tracks. And by contrast, she also found that Stamford, Connecticut, which has an integration program, had done some innovative things to try to make sure that all students have access to strong curriculum and strong teachers. And probably the most important method they use is something called embedded honors programs, where rather than having an honors track and then the regular track for students that often can be segregated, they have one track that's an honors track, and then within that, students who are more academically inclined are given more complicated assignments that are that go deeper. They're, you know, they continue to be challenged, but within the same classroom rather than in a completely separate classroom from others.
Mm-hmm. So apart from that, as we're thinking about sort of the headlines of this, about the role that economic, socioeconomic diversity plays, I wonder what you see as, Richard, the biggest challenges to implementing what you've saw in these 9 case studies. We talked about choice, for example, in Champaign, what Chicago's doing with its magnet schools and its selective enrollment. What are the biggest challenges to implementing this across the country?
Well, I think there is a social science consensus that poverty concentrations are bad for education, but there's this unfortunate political consensus, I think an outdated political consensus, that, well, there's not that much you can do about it. And for much of the Obama administration, in fact, that was true, where the major effort that the president put forward in education was investing $7 billion into struggling schools to try to make them work better. It was kind of the old separate, trying to make separate but equal work. Towards the end of the administration, the Secretary of Education, John King, started pushing diversity, and so I think was beginning to show that politically it is possible to promote integration. The key is, though, to make sure that middle-class parents recognize that diversity is going to be good for their kids as well. And that can be done in part by providing special magnet programs that will appeal to certain parents whose kids would thrive in an arts program or a science program, and also to educate people about the ways in which all students benefit from socioeconomic and racial diversity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about the Obama administration. The obvious question now, then, is with the incoming Trump administration, with what we've seen of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's advocacy for charter schools and for voucher programs, what's your sense of where the Trump administration will take all of this?
Well, there was an early and very discouraging signal recently when Secretary DeVos canceled an innovative program designed to promote socioeconomic diversity. It's clearly not a priority for the Trump administration. And that's where, you know, I thank God that we have a system of federalism in this country, that most education decisions are made at the state and local level. And I think we're likely to see more interest in school diversity efforts because people across the political spectrum recognize we just went through one of the most divisive elections in memory, and we need public schools to remind people what they have in common as Americans. You know, our democracy is really under threat, and we don't want a system where a politician can scapegoat minorities, given that, you know, students don't have that much experience with those of different backgrounds. Integrated schools, by contrast, make it much harder for a demagogue to come in and single out minorities and blame them for society's ills. So I think even though we're not likely to get much federal support for school integration, we may see greater dedication to school integration at the state and local level.
Richard Kahlenberg is senior fellow with the bipartisan think tank in Washington, the Century Foundation. We'll be tweeting out more of those links so you can read that case study. Richard, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Julie Wirth, a reporter at the News Gazette. Julie, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Nyla.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we revisit our conversation with climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, atmospheric scientist and associate professor of political science at Texas Tech University. She's also the host of a PBS digital series that came out last year called Global Weirding, Climate, Politics, and Religion.
Regardless of what we might think about climate change, many of us have bought into a very insidious myth about it. To care about climate change, we think, we have to be a certain type of person. If we're a green, granola-eating, Birkenstock-wearing liberal, we do. Otherwise, why bother?
In her series, she discusses how religion can often get tied up in the issue of climate change.
Climate change isn't just a scientific issue. It is also a question of right and wrong. Science can tell us what's likely to happen to our food, our water resources, our health, even our economy, depending on how much fossil fuels we burn. But this is where the science stops. Science can't tell us what's the right thing to do. We have some tough choices to make. And for that, we need to engage our hearts. And for many of us here in North America and around the world, what's in our hearts has a lot to do with our faith.
Catherine Hayhoe joined us in studio back in April when she was visiting the University of Illinois to give a lecture. She talked with Illinois Public Media's Brian Moline about how climate change has become one of the most politically polarized issues in the United States. In such a politically charged environment, are we still able to act on climate, or is it too late? We'll also be discussing the rising popularity of wearable technologies that aim to promote healthy behaviors and learn why two Illinois colleges are offering scholarships for competitive video gaming. Tune in to hear those conversations next time on The 21st. That's all the time we have here today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. Also available on iTunes and Android if you have Alexa. Easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st if you have that enabled. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us by phone, email, social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for The 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us there. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want to ask us on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction engineering support comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.